out to explore. What was it like to climb Denali in 1970? I'm your host, Paul Tordock, and on this show, I'm joined by Tom Kinsler, Dan Osborne, Mike Salee, Steve O'Brien, Ed Minot, and Dick Jablonowski, as they vividly describe their climb. The name of the group and climb was M4C4. We recorded the show gathered around a table at a restaurant in Talkeetna, a fitting location for their story, but not without its audio interruptions. Stay tuned for Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. So we'll start off with Tom Kinsler, and Tom's going to start with sort of describing the name of the group and a little bit of where that name came from. And let's start with Tom. Tom?
Great. So the Park Service required us to file an expedition name in addition to all the medical forms and other biographies. And so we named our expedition C4M4, which reflected the fact that we were a group of three Eastern climbers and three Alaskan climbers. And the three Eastern climbers met each other and did a lot of climbs, winter and all seasons, in the Adirondack Mountains of New York State. And we named ourselves Charlie's Colden Climbing Club, as Colden was a place where we would hang out a lot. And then the M4 was Mount McKinley's Muldrow Marauders, because we were going up the Muldrow route from the north and then onto Carson's Ridge and so forth. And so the group coalesced because I was able to spend my junior year abroad, as I programmed it at University of Alaska Fairbanks, and came up and I met Dan Osborne. And we hit it off very well and did a lot of climbing over that season. And at the end of that year, we said next year we got to put together McKinley or our Denali expedition. So he and I worked to formulate the initial plans and develop a climbing team that would work well together.
Great. Thanks, Tom. Let's go around and introduce the team then. And we'll start next with Dan.
Dan Osborne, and what did you want to know about me?
Why don't you tell everybody where you're living at, what you did, and maybe your role on the team if you had one.
I'm currently living in Nevada, but I've lived most of my life in Fairbanks. And my role in the team was correspondent to Tom for the beginning part of the winter of 69-70, where we wrote hundreds of letters back and forth, it seems like, and organized this climb. I became chief cook and bottle washer by default, I think, and organizer of the Fairbanks side of it, which was the three climbers from the university.
Great. Thanks. And who else? Who wants to go next here? Why don't you give us your name, where you're from, and a little bit about how you got into this expedition.
My name is Mike Salee. I'm from Ketchikan, Alaska, and actually I guess the only one in the group that was actually born in Alaska. I got involved with this climb basically from the previous year, 1969. Dan and Tom and I and actually Grace Holman were on a first ascent of a mountain in the Alaska Range called Mount Kimball, and then I think that Tom and Dan probably figured, everybody needs a good mule on their expedition. So, and I was a pretty good packer, so I became the one of the members of the Denali expedition.
So we got the mule, we got the cook and the powder.
Mike was much more than the mule. He also has a great sense of humor, and he's a great companion.
All right, great. Thanks. Okay, Steve?
Yeah, hi, Steve O'Brien. Yeah, I just gotten out of the Army and was going to the University of Alaska. And at the time, I just liked the outdoors and running around, so I got into joined the Alpine Club and started, you know, messing around the Alaska Range and met Dan and Tom and everybody who was in the club. And so that's how I got into mountain climbing and essentially, you know, worked into the Denali climb. And since then, I mean, essentially, I gravitated out. I never climbed another mountain after McKinley. So
this did it for you, huh?
Well, no. It's just I moved out into the bush, and I started trapping in the winter, and I eventually ended up running a fish camp on the Yukon, and that's what I've been doing kind of ever since.
Wow, so still trap still out there in Manly? And,
still out in Manly, yeah. My trap line's getting shorter and shorter, but I still get out every winter. So.
That's great. And, Steve, what kind of climbing? You mentioned some climbing beforehand. How did you prepare for this trip?
Well, you know, it's funny because I grew up in New York State, so I climbed quite a few of the mountains in the Adirondacks that Tom and Ed and those guys climbed back when there was a thing called the 46ers or something. You were kind of, you know, try to climb all these mountains over 4,000 feet. So I got involved, but essentially that was ancient history then. And before that, we just did some climbing off the Alaska Highway. You know, there's some mountains there in Mount Kokona. Which was probably the biggest thing I climbed before McKinley or Denali. Yeah.
All right. Thanks, Steve. Ed?
Yeah, Ed Minot. I guess I knew Tom from shortly after kindergarten. We grew up in the same town, went to the same high school, went to different colleges, but we got together in the winter and did quite a bit of climbing. Most of my climbing was in the east, although we did a little bit in Colorado. Tom and I were out there for a summer. And then got invited along on this climb. That was 52 years ago, and this is my first time back in Alaska since then. So I've had the longest Alaska hiatus of any of the group.
Well, welcome back.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
And lastly, Dick.
Hi, Dick Jablonowski. I was the comic relief. I was living in New Jersey at the time, and I knew Tom and Ed from doing mountains in the east and going on canoe trips and so on, and also Pete Brown, who 2 years later we climbed Russell with. And then when Tom did his junior year abroad, he wound up thinking it'd be good to get somebody from the east that could put up with those guys, so there I was. I do remember one image of Mike. He had some god-awful load. He was taking like the nth plus X load or that day, and he fell over. Now, he was roped up right on a glacier, but the pack was so heavy he fell over. It took several people to get him upright again.
Fun. So let's move on. So that's our team, and we'll talk a little bit now go into sort of your route and the actual climb. So who wants to start sort of describing? I think you started at Wonder Lake, was that right?
The route started in Fairbanks at the railroad depot, where two of us drove Volkswagens fully loaded with climbing equipment and food, and the rest came on the train. We met at McKinley Park Station and shuttled people out to Wonder Lake. Now, the first real obstacle was crossing the McKinley River, which we kind of was hoping we'd cross in the ice, but that was June 2nd, I think, when we started. And the ice had melted, so we kind of crossed it with the ice water. And then we went south down to the McGonigal Pass and into the Muldrow Glacier, which was the original route of the sourdoughs. And there the climbing started.
So there was, I don't think there was a Parks Highway then.
There wasn't a Parks Highway. Actually, I did a preliminary survey of some of that before. It was just a jungle trail. But there was no Parks Highway, and it was Denali Highway we drove into on. We didn't fly in. We didn't have that much money or desire to use that sort of technique for climbing. And so we backpacked everything. Of course, it's 25 miles about airline from Wonder Lake to the summit of McKinley. And I guess I'm going to call it McKinley rather than Denali, because it was when we climbed it. And the old habits die hard. So we packed everything. We went up about three times the first two-thirds of the mountain to get everything up, and about twice the last one-sixth, and only once the last bit.
Well, the interesting thing is we had skis and snowshoes because we were being careful. And it was sort of like siege climbing from those days. But we had relatively good weather the whole way. We had one great adventure in crossing one of the streams before we got to the glacier. And we had all borrowed white Mickey Mouse boots. And we strapped on crampons.
Classic, yep.
Yep. One of the boots sprung a leak. This is not good when your boot is full of water. It's hard to climb. Your foot freezes, right? So then we had to go into recovery mode. What do?
Well, this was Ed Minot's boot. He had the largest feet.
Uh-huh.
And therefore, we all borrowed his boot.
That's convenient. Right, yeah.
Nice. Go across the Clearwater Creek and then toss them back over to the next person. So the first strategy was a little bit of surgery where Ed cut open the toe of the boot. And it's got a felt inside the rubber, and we stuck some carabiners and other things in there to open space and help the hopefully help it dry out, and that didn't work. So then I don't know who it was. Somebody, Dan had a radio that linked out to Dick Collins at Lake Minchemina, and so we put out a request for some help from some Fairbanks friends to see if they could get us another pair of size 12 boots that would replace these, and it didn't quite work out that way, but it happened.
So I think that radio comes into play later. What kind of radio was it?
Well, that was a CB radio. I was a ham radio operator, but it turned out that CB was a better choice because of the people available to listen for us. And also, if I was the only radio operator on the trip and nothing happened to me, nobody could use the radio because I would have taken a Morse code radio, which would have worked better. But to use the CB, so that meant anybody in the party could use it.
Back to the boot things, Steve. Yeah. So I had the second biggest feet. So we need a pair of size 12s, but we didn't get them. We got a pair of 10 wides. So
oops.
I gave the 11s to Ed, and he could just barely cram in, and I just barely crammed in the 10 wides. So we ended up climbing the mountain. Boots that were too small for us, and you sure noticed it going downhill, stubbing your toe every step.
But is Ed here? Yeah. We were rescued with a drop. The plane went over several times, and we kind of thought, come on, drop something. They finally did. Not only did we get the boots, but I think 52 years later, we can admit that we also got 1.97 pounds of steak, frozen strawberries, and a few oranges.
Wow.
Yeah, ballast.
Do you remember who the pilot was?
We think it's Jerry Murray.
Murray, for sure.
Okay. Yeah. Well, that's very nice.
We've been arguing about that the last several days of this reunion.
You know, sometimes that approach is sometimes some, you know, especially that McKinley River Bar is quite something. Did you settle in with the park bus? I can't remember the park buses were going.
This was
there.
Back in the dark ages of the park. There was no buses.
Okay.
In order to visit the park, you actually were kind of obligated to have your own private car, because if you hitchhiked, the park would arrest you. That was part of the reasons why we used available transportation, which is two bugs.
That's them.
And actually, it was interesting because we got as far as Eielson. We got as far as Eielson, and the road was blocked with snow for a couple of days. Oh, we'll open it up real soon, boys. Well, Danny and Tom and others had all spent a huge amount of time taking our all of our food, and we laid it out in probably a 500 foot long line, and we bagged it up each day's provisions, and we had how many days? 60 days, something like that. 45 days. We didn't want to break into it, and so we were stuck at Eielson, and there were a few tourist buses where they gave the tourists box lunches. And so we were sort of standing at Eielson when the tourist boxes showed up. We were kind of hungry because we hadn't wanted to break into our food stores, and so we were standing there caging food. And some of us actually got some chicken box lunches from the tourists, but the most amazing thing was when a woman gets off the bus and
this is Ed Minot. You must be Louise's son. And somebody from 3,000 miles away in Maine, I don't know how she did it, recognized me and gave me a box lunch. I was very grateful. Everyone else was incredibly jealous.
Yeah, I was going to say, did you share? No, it's a team.
Of course not.
Well, I have a full story about that. I, too, have been at Eielson begging food from tourists. And it's really good food, and if you're hungry, it works.
It felt like the squirrels.
Yeah. So we got across the McKinley River Bar, apparently, and across Clear Creek, and then we started up. So let's talk about the route from there. Who would like to talk about that?
So we crossed the McKinley Bar in the river. We went up to Turtle Hill, which is the high point going south. Continued over the hill, reached the Clearwater River, which is where we trashed Ed's boot. And then we moved into the Cache Creek drainage and started up that. And by that time, we were kind of quasi-tundra, but the riverbed was alder thickets, 10 feet so we're tall, but a nice gravel bed to walk along. And the story I have at that point is I was on my last relay around midnight or something, hiking by myself. Everybody else was in front of me, and I'm just following my feet because I was really tired after walking for 10 or 12 hours. And all of a sudden, I hear a whoomph, and I look up. And there's a grizzly 15 feet away from me on all fours just looking at me. And then it gets up on its haunches, and it starts sniffing. And then I realize I've got some Hickory Farm summer sausages tied to the top of my pack. And I'm telling myself, just don't pass out. Just stay cool. And I looked at the bear looked at me, and finally I said, you know, I know I'm not supposed to move, but I started taking baby steps back. And the bear lost interest in me. And so I took a big, wide circle to leave him in his domain. Went further up the creek, and the guys had gone up a lateral moraine on the side, sort of a big gravel slope, and there was a nice flat tundra bench. And they
great
were
walking.
Great walking, flat walking, easy on the feet. And they'd gone about a half a mile along the bench, and that was camp. But some of them had dropped part of their loads at the top of the steep hill. And I started going up the hill with my load, and Steve O'Brien is coming back to this dropped load, and he sees a grizzly bear has almost gotten to it. So he starts running across the tundra, waving an ice axe, yelling and screaming. And what does the bear do? It drops down over the slope and starts running right at me.
Yeah.
Just 30 minutes earlier, it'd been totally freaked out by the first bear. And as you know, bears don't run very well downhill. You know, their short front legs make it a little tough. So this bear is trying to do sort of one of those roadrunner, spin the feet type of thing and stop. It did before it got to me. It turned around, it ran back up to the top of the bench, and then over what I think is about a 3,000-foot hill on the far side without stopping.
It wow.
was totally freaked out, as was I.
That's great. So this is Paul Tordak. You're listening to the Outdoor Explorer in Alaska Public Media. We're talking to a group of gentlemen who climbed McKinley, Denali in 1970, Mike Salee, Tom Kinsler, Steve O'Brien, Ed Minot, Dip Jabanowski, and Dan Osborne. So let's continue on here. We got up onto the glacier, got over McDonagle Pass, I assume, and from there describe what happened next. Mike, we're up on the glacier now. So
I'm not quite on the glacier yet. I just want to correct the record a little bit from what Tom says. I was behind him.
Oh, okay.
And the first thing I see is Tom coming back toward me, and he says, there's a bear behind me. So Tom and I both started talking loudly and making, like he says, a wide circle around this bear. The other thing about that was that morning, that I got kind of bored with the actual distance we were making each day, and I took off a couple hours early and way the heck and gone up the route with a load, and then dropped that, and then came back. Well, then everybody else had to go all the way that whole distance to get up to that so that we'd be with it and sort of keep the bears away from it.
Yeah.
But anyway, then we did get up to the, finally got up to McGonagall Pass,
yep.
And that's where I remember seeing the plaque there that somebody had died,
mm-hmm. yeah.
you know, decades before.
The memorial to a Mexican climber who had died. So that was a good way to start the trip, reading this memorial to somebody else who had died.
Yeah. So now we're on the Muldrow Glacier. And so we're carrying loads. Listeners aren't familiar, when we're talking about relaying, another word for it is carrying loads. So you're moving, transporting all your gear up and coming back and shuttling back and forth. Correct?
Yeah, so this was, I think we were doing three relays a day, three trips, or, you know, five one-way trips each day at that point, and all the way up, I think we did that all the way up to the top of the Muldrow. Yeah. So we actually climbed the mountain three times up to the at least as far as the top of the Muldrow. And then we, of course, had, you know, it started out, I think, a lot of rain maybe, and then we started getting into snow. And
what time of year was this?
Early June.
Okay.
And when we got under the lower Muldrow, we switched over to skis.
Okay, you're on skis. That was my other question.
Which was good because it was much more efficient, particularly coming back down with an empty pack to pick up the next load.
Particularly with Mike, who skied very fast.
Yeah. Nobody wanted to be on his rope because you're going to get dragged up.
Yeah.
And then pull down.
So you're on skis. And what other kind of equipment did you have in 1970? And I assume wool pants and a lot of wool.
Everything was wool. A lot of army surplus. Well, most of us wore wool pants, wool mittens, wool hats, wool flannel jackets, except Mike.
I'm kind of at a loss. I don't remember what I had. It might have been blue jeans.
Yeah, it was blue jeans.
You had Kent custom blue jeans.
This is Steve again. I actually climbed McKinley in a pair of Lee Stay Pressed pants, work pants. I still remember.
Wow.
Not a smart choice, but all I could afford at the time. I still had the crease when I got there.
And while most of us had new long johns, somebody had two pair of long johns they would wear, because the knees were worn out, and I put on one pair of backwards, if I remember right. We were not a luxury trip with a high budget.
Apparently not at all. And what about climbing equipment?
Well, we all had what you would expect. In those days, it was gold line rope, and we had crampons, and, of course, the Mickey Mouse boots, which aren't exactly really stiff, but we didn't have to front point, so it wasn't a big deal. And we had snowshoes, some were Westovers, as well as the wooden skis, probably, Asness or something like that.
Yeah.
Ice axes.
Wooden ice axes, yep. And tents, I assume you had tents.
Silver slings and prussets, yeah.
Yeah.
Just going to say, we had 2 4-man tents, so we were pretty luxurious. We had 3 people in each tent, and we got in these dry cell foam pads that entirely covered the floor, so we were always fighting moisture. So this kept us separated from the snow, and something else.
We arranged it so that we could have 3 ropes of 2, which is a much faster combination to move, or when we got into heavy crevasse zones, 2 ropes of 3, which meant that if the lead person fell in a crevasse, which was typical, then that third person could come up and rescue the first person while the second person held them from falling in.
Okay, wait a minute. People found crevasses?
You know, there are known to be crevasses up there, and we were actually pretty careful initially, and we were doing a lot of probing with our ice axes, and that's just too slow. So after a while, we started doing body probing, which is you just keep a tight rope on the first guy, and if he goes in, he doesn't fall very far.
As long as the rope is tight.
If I can interject, this is Steve again.
Yep.
We developed a pretty good technique going up, I'm sure, standard mountain climbing procedure. We all relay a couple of loads, and then usually what would happen is 2 guys would go and put a route in for the next day, and they take these garden wands we had and maybe go up a couple of miles, find a good route through. 2 guys would stick around and set up camp, and then usually me and Mike, because we were the brain-dead mules, would go down and pick up the last load. And that worked out real well because you might get up the next morning and you got a big whiteout and you've been stuck in the tent, but we had the wands we could follow so we didn't waste a day.
And we went in, well, I guess we came out 30-odd days later, so it was reasonably cold and snowy when we went in, so also a lot of the snow was covering the crevasses, millions of snow bridges, many we didn't see. We tried to do as best we could, work our way through and go perpendicular. Every now and then we just miss one. When we came out, they had all opened up.
Yeah, that's exciting. And so up off the Muldrow, you went up Carstens, is that right?
Yes.
Did I have that right? Yep. So I want to talk about getting up on there.
Yeah, well, I mean, you get to the head of the Muldrow, this ice fall coming down called the Harper Ice Fall from the Harper Glaciers above you. And so you go to the left and you go up Carson's Ridge. So you're starting from about 12,005, and you go up Carson's Ridge and you get off it at 14,600 at Brown's Tower. And so that took us two relays to get to the top. You get up onto the ridge and there's a place you could actually camp. Kind of exposed if you had a bad storm, but it's big enough you could hide. And then you make the last leap all the way up to Brown's Tower, where you camp there, and there's a side slope you have to traverse along for about a half a mile called Parker Pass until you get back onto the Harper Glacier.
But that campsite halfway up Carson's Ridge is probably one of the most glorious places I've ever spent a night, because the exposure down to the Trilica Glacier on one side, and then down to the Muldrow, which was now at least 1,000, 1,500 feet below us, it was just spectacular. Fortunately for us, the weather was still, and the skies were pretty clear, and remarkable.
And one of the nice things was when the ice fall calved off and great chunks went down to the Muldrow Glacier where we'd previously been camped, you were in a safe spot.
And I might add that many of the times when we had the option, we'd try to, we'd put a campsite in, we'd pack it down, probe around, make sure there weren't crevasses, pack it down, set up the tents, and then we'd try to always make sure that we had nothing loose outside of the tents. So we had everything sort of attached to something. So if a wind or 5 feet of snow comes through, which happened one night, we could find stuff the next morning. And we generally tried to be near a crevasse just in case our tents blew away. We could at least jump down the crevasse.
Maybe I should mention, as probably the person with the least glacier experience, in fact, none, it was a pretty safety-conscious group, and we made several attempts at building an igloo almost as a refuge, but we had caches on the way up in case we had to beat a retreat. At Brown Tower, we built a rather spacious ice cave, which we could retreat to as well. And also on the way up, we practiced rescue from crevasses, which panned out sometimes and not others, as we might relate later. Yeah. But we'd heard of so many problems on the mountain that I was very glad that everyone seemed to have safety first and making the summit second.
That said, where were you getting your information from? It's not like the Park Service had a talking to ranger station or anything like that, and there was no internet. And so where were you getting your information from?
In 1970, the last place you'd go would be the National Park Service to get information on climbing McKinley. They had no experience on the mountain. None of their staff did. You learned it from other climbers who were done more than you, and by climbing with them. And that was basically how you learned.
Plus, back east, some of us participated in winter mountaineering schools, and we climbed all winter because it wasn't that ferocious, at least in the Adirondacks and the Whites.
Yeah. So, let's see. We're about to take a break. Why don't we go and take our break now? So you've been listening to Outdoor Explorer, and your host, Paul Tordat. I'm here with six gentlemen who climbed Denali, Mount McKinley, in 1970. Their name and expedition is C4M4. We'll take a short break and be right back with more of their story, including a rescue.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. Find the show anytime as a free podcast in the iTunes Store or connect with us online at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to Outdoor Explorer. We're sitting here with the C4M4 1970 climb of Mount McKinley or Denali. So we left off, we're at Carson's Ridge. So Tom, it's Tom Kensler. Why don't you take us from there? What's describe the route from there?
So the ridge tops out at Brown Tower, and then there's a nice horizontal stretch called Parker Pass. So we traversed that, and we set up a nice bomb-proof camp, which is now at the very lower part of the Harper Glacier. And over the course of the next couple of days, we moved our camp up about 1,000 feet a day, again with multiple relays to get our gear up there. And our final high camp was at 17,500 feet or so. And we were all feeling tired, but the weather was really good, and there was a certain element of summit fever, I think, and we said, hey, let's go for it. So we went off in two ropes of three, and I was clearly the weakest of the six of us, and I plodded along and got as far as Denali Pass, a little over 18,000 feet, and just was not feeling well and said, you know, this is it, I got to go back down. And so two guys went down, and then the other three went up hoping to make the summit, but turned around at Archdeacon Tower, right. And Ed has the key descriptor.
The hero of the whole trip, I think, was probably Mike Stilley, who was always carried perhaps 30 or 40 pounds more than any of the rest of us. And by the time we got to Archdeacon Tower, Mike just pushed himself backwards onto the snow, and I've got a photo of him with his arms out, and he just said, "I'm totally buggered," and I think that summed it up for the rest of us. We headed down, and got back to the camp, and I think Tom was starting to feel worse at that point.
So I'm going to interrupt just for a second. So Dan, you at the break talked about your guys. So the lessons you learned from other climbs and sort of the philosophy you went in as we go into this, talking about this rescue.
I can say at least half of us had done a lot of reading the literature of climbs and of knowing things that other people had done wrong, and they had talked about it in their books or whatever, in their magazine articles. And so we discussed that we were never going to leave somebody alone in a tent while the stronger people all left, or we would not split the party into a strong party and a weak party groups, because what has traditionally been a death trap for many climbers is the weak party all die because they didn't have any strength left. And so we decided we were not going to do that. So that was part of the motivation to not go further.
Okay, so now we're back at high camp, and Tom, you're not feeling well.
I'm not feeling well. I was having a hard time breathing, although it wasn't particularly raspy as I remember it. But I was also more troublesome losing my balance. And so I was sort of staggered back into camp, and then I could hardly sit up. I certainly couldn't stand up unassisted, and we now know that I developed cerebellar edema principally, and perhaps a little bit of pulmonary edema as well. And so at this point, I don't remember very much. There are a few little moments, but the others were tracking me pretty carefully.
Yeah, Dick?
So we kind of knew everybody was feeling badly or tired. It was altitude. Some folks, many of us, had bad headaches. Some folks had really bad headaches, weren't getting enough sleep. Tom kept insisting, "I'll be okay tomorrow, we're going for the summit." But we were keeping a really close eye on him.
Yeah, when I realized Tom couldn't stand up, that was, when you have someone immobile at 18,000 feet and can't move on their own, that's the disaster time. That's the time you pull the plug and you go back.
So the night before, we had kept a close eye on Tom. We kept waking him up to take his pulse, and we compared his pulse to our pulses, and it was faster than ours. We all averaged in the high 40s.
Okay, so what next?
One thing you ought to know is that today a lot of climbers all know about cerebral edema and pulmonary edema, all caused by high altitude. They have acronyms for them and everything else. But when we went up there, high altitude cerebral edema was basically an unknown thing. And we had been driven by two different MDs in Fairbanks, training us and recognizing high altitude pulmonary edema, because that was the known killer at altitude. And, you know, there's these five things you got to look for, and Tom had two or three of them, but he was missing the other ones, and he was insisting he was okay. Well, we eventually learned not to trust him.
When we heard gurgling in Tom's lungs, we knew the game was over.
Yeah, that was my question. How did you all make the decision? Like, at what point were you like, okay, it's time to do something about this?
He couldn't stand up on his own.
Okay. And his lungs were gurgling.
Okay.
I mean, that's emergency red light.
Yeah. And so what did you do? Steve?
Well, essentially, we decided you either got to get them oxygen or get them down, which essentially gets a person more oxygen. So Dick and I took the radio and scampered up to Denali Pass.
Scampered. Right, yeah.
Definitely. Fogged up to Denali Pass, and we were able to make radio contact at Lake Minchumina to see about getting a helicopter in for a rescue. Meanwhile, the other guys made a makeshift toboggan out of skis and backpack frames and started to bring Tom down the glacier. Well, by the time Dick and I caught up to everybody again after we came back down, Ed had fallen in a crevasse. So we come up here, we got Tom comatose on a sled, Ed's in a crevasse, the rope's cutting in the lip. Dan and Mike were able to get him up to the lip, but couldn't get him over, the rope will cut into the lip, couldn't get him over the lip. But by the time Dick and I showed up, then we had enough muscle to grab him by the scruff of the neck and haul him up over. And then we continued on down.
So I think earlier you mentioned snowshoes, but what were you using for a sled?
Well, we made a makeshift sled out of skis with backpack frames lashed to them.
Actually, we used snowshoes crossways.
Was that the way it was?
On top of the skis, remember. And we took all of our foam pads and put them on top of that because it was pretty lumpy. And then threw Tom on top of that, and we put a tent fly over his sleeping bag so he didn't get wet, and tied the whole mess together. So he was hogtied.
So Steve and I had scampered up to the Collin, where I got lucky and gotten through Dick Collins. Thank you, Dick. And he triggered the rescue at the then pretty much new Alaska Rescue Coordination Center, I think it was called.
Yeah.
And it was a combined federal, military, civilian rescue, but they hadn't had a lot of practice, and we gave them some. And when we were up there, we noticed that the guys that were evacuating Ed had stopped for a long time. We kept looking back, and they were still stopped. And I felt awful. I was afraid Tom had died.
Well, that's a dramatic moment.
So Ed was on the front with I think he had a loop around his chest of a line, and he was towing the sled from the front. And Dan and I were on the sides of the sled, kind of as also towing, but also as brakes. You know, to slow it down. And so then, of course, Ed went into the crevasse, and then Dan and I had to tie Tom, who was on the litter, off and separate him from the whole mess so he didn't get pulled in along with Ed. And then we went to try to get Ed out of the crevasse.
Tom was in about, his feet was about less than 3 feet from the edge of the crevasse, and it was a pretty good slope he was on. And so we used all of our best mountaineering techniques to keep him out and try to get Ed out.
I think Ed said he went in head first. And, of course, you know, we all had packs on parachute cord. We all had Jumar or Prusik knots so that we could go out the ideal way. You know, we could climb back up. It doesn't work so well when your pack is dragging you down, you're upside down in a crevasse.
Actually, I think, Dick, I think you had the only Jumars, if I remember, because I think we had to use Prusik knots in order to rig up a mechanical advantage with pulleys and Prusik knots. And the Prusik knots jammed when we wanted them to slip, and then they slipped when we wanted them to jam. Of course, we're dealing with frozen ropes. And so we were just kind of going back and forth there. And of course, some of us had taken sleeping pills, I think. And so we were kind of not very quick at that point either.
Yeah, everybody was having trouble sleeping, so a lot of us took sleeping pills. But one of the things you ought to understand, once you get above 16,000 feet, half the oxygen is below you in the planet. And so you only got half the oxygen. So all your mental functions have slowed way up. Now, I used to be a guinea pig in the university's altitude chamber, so I had quite a bit of experience in being slowed up with lack of oxygen. And we had all these difficulties going on. Everything moves at glacial speed, no pun intended there, when you're trying to do something. You know, is this how you tie that knot? You better check it about three times because you could tie it wrong. And it's the same thing with the Prusik knot slipping and everything else.
So here we are. We're at 16,000 or somewhere there. You're trying to get Tom down, who has a cerebral and probably a pulmonary edema, it sounds like. Ed's in a crevasse, maybe upside down, maybe not. No, not upside down, okay. And you all sound like you're on sleeping pills. That's a pretty traumatic moment. How was the weather? Was the weather cooperating, hopefully? Yeah. Weather was good, yeah. Okay. Okay, so apparently we got that. Now, one thing I want to get back to is you mentioned talking to someone on the radio, and that was, who was that and where were they at?
I made arrangements as being the radio operator to have people standing by and listening both in Fairbanks and at Lake Minchumna. Dick Collins, who worked for the FAA for many years, a ham radio operator and a friend, he was the one that responded, and he, with his FAA connections, knew better and just bypassed everybody and went right to the Rescue Coordination Center.
Of course, we used the radio somewhat frequently after that over a couple of days of trying to get Tom out of there and having weather roll in. And this wasn't just pushing a button on a radio. This was a CB rig with standard batteries off the hardware shelf. And they were used somewhat, right? So we had to keep them warm. So somebody kept the batteries next to their chest until we wanted to use the radio, then we popped in the radio. So it was kind of painful.
Yeah, and so how many days then did it take? I guess at what point, I guess a helicopter came in? Like how did the actual rescue materialize?
Well, day one of the helicopter was, the helicopter flew over a million miles away and circled us and left us, and we were kind of dejected at that point.
And blowing clouds.
And Don Sheldon did a loop overhead, and that we went down one more step, and we camped at 15,000 feet because it was a major task to cross Parker Pass back over to Brown Tower. And we figured once we got there, there's not going to be a place a helicopter is going to be able to get us until we get all the way down to the Muldo. So that was kind of a stop point for us and stop and reconsider where we were and what was going to happen. So on the third day after we'd call for help, the helicopter started circling again, and they finally landed.
Well, I might add that my understanding is that there were a lot of Vietnam folks back from Vietnam at the Anchorage base, and the colonel had said, we're going to get those boys, and he put major resources into doing it. We did see, we had blowing clouds in a lot of the time, those few days, and we did see a Chinook go overhead once. We saw Sheldon go overhead at least once, if not twice. He was gonna try and drop bottles of oxygen if he could see us, but he never saw us. And every time we saw one of these things, we'd grab the radio, rush as high as we could, and say, they're overhead. Well, by the time we got far away and up and got the radio running, and then we get Dick Collins, who would then phone somebody who would then call the Rescue Coordination Center, who would then radio the helicopter. They were 30 miles up the glacier.
But apparently it succeeded.
It succeeded. So the last thing, we were lowering Tom, of course, and he had come down 3,000 feet or so, which helped, but he was hanging in there. The last thing we wanted to do was drag him down Karstens Ridge. That would have been terribly dangerous for him and us. But we were ready to do it that morning. So we were just about rigged up and about to kick him off, and two Hueys come in.
Well, the thing that I remember about the Hueys is when they came up, I needed to get off the mountain myself to get back to a job, and so I was over there along with Tom, and one of the guys on the Huey came out and said, only one guy is going to go back with us. And so that was Tom, of course. So they loaded up Tom, and I guess somebody else can explain the helicopter takeoff.
Well, so they one of them stayed far away watching in case the other helicopter that's coming in for the rescue had a problem, and so there would be witnesses and they get more help. And the helicopter came in and did a lot of power checks. We kept waiting for him to come in. He'd come in a little bit, keep his engines revving high, go back out, come in a little closer, go back out. Finally came in and the loadmaster was waving us away. Can't figure it out. Finally figured out that he didn't want us around with ropes on because he's afraid they might get sucked into the blades.
Yeah.
So we figured that out. Reluctantly, we dropped our ropes. And then the helicopter comes in and he hovers full power, total full power. The loadmaster slides the door open. I ran up there and two guys dragged Tom over in his sleeping bag. And the loadmaster opens the door and says, one only, no equipment, one only.
And so I got put into the helicopter. I might add, Mike was one of the guys who dragged me over. And you know, this is the first time in 52 years I've seen him since
Aww.
Then. And it's great.
Yeah.
But I'm in the helicopter, and we take off, and there's no lift at all in that Huey at 15,000 feet. We go over the lip of the Harper Icefall, which is a really impressive drop of close to 3,000 feet, and there's no lift. We go over the edge, and I remember, I was cognizant enough, we just start dropping like a rock.
Oh, boy.
The pilot screams, and he catches his air above the Muldrow Glacier. But there were 10 or 15 seconds or whatever it was where even I knew that things weren't as the pilots wanted. But once I got down to the Muldrow, and particularly, you know, sort of out onto the tundra, just having that oxygen again, even though my balance took days or weeks or forever to come back, kind of I knew at that point that I was going to get through this.
Yeah.
And that good things were going to happen. And if I can just follow up on the story a little bit. So they take me out to near the park entrance, and I think, what did we decide it was? It was Summit?
Summit.
Anyway, the Army had set up a staging ground where they had big fuel caches and other helicopters and whatnot, and they pull down, and people are cheering. They open up the door, and what's the first thing that happens is an Army reporter comes up to me and stuffs a microphone in my face and says, "Tell me what happened." You know.
Wow.
I just mumbled a few things. Didn't say anything coherent. I just you know, was not functioning well enough. And then he smartened up and he said, "Okay, what does it say on that helicopter?" And I say, "U.S. Army." And again, there's a big cheer, and that's what got broadcast over Armed Services Radio.
Yeah.
I've got to hand it to those guys, though. They put a huge effort in. The crews were really scared. They were thousands of feet above their service ceiling. They were above the recommended maximum ceiling.
Wow.
And they'd stripped everything, including most of the radios, everything they could, they'd stripped out of the helicopters.
Yeah, that's something. Yeah, and that's, you know, and they've really evolved since then with their rescue abilities. So now it's a regular thing, unfortunately. Tom, you're back in town. And then what the rest of you do? Headed back up, eh?
Yeah, we turned around, and we originally were going to climb both peaks, North and South Peak. But we decided Tom was in North Peak.
We're out of time, but... strangely, we were in a celebratory mood because we knew that Tom was safe.
Yeah.
We also knew that we're going to have to climb the mountain very quickly. Somebody can help me out here, but I think we went up to the 17.5 camp that night and then climbed the mountain the following day. Does that sound right?
I think it took 2 days.
Okay.
Yeah.
I was pulled off on the 28th, and you guys summited on the 1st.
So we had a cache down at the down by Brown's Tower, I believe, in a snow cave, and we had to go down and resupply ourselves. And of course, by that time, we were all pretty well acclimatized. I mean, we had been up there then for several days, and so, you know, above 15,000, and so we were starting to feeling pretty good shape. So we went down, resupplied. And then we just headed on back up, and I don't remember if we camped before we went to the summit or just went.
I think on the way up, we got caught and had a little whiteout spindrift and whatnot, and we decided that there was a good spot to camp there, and we stopped and slept for maybe 6-8 hours or something, and got up again and broke camp and went up to where the old camp was, pitched that, took a break, and then went for the summit.
So we made the summit and turned around, and everyone was eager to get out of there, and we wanted to keep an eye on the food. I remember we had a whiteout for a few hours, and it was where we had to probe to see if there was anything under our feet. We could not tell which was up and which was down. But we came out in just a few days, and Mike had to get to go fishing. I mean, there was a boat waiting for him, so he was really eager to get out.
So that's amazing. So this is you're listening to Outdoor Explorer in Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Paul Tordat. We're talking to a group of guys who climbed Denali in 1970. So you've summited, you've gotten one member out. Sounds like they had a little weather, but overall weather sounded pretty decent, for Denali at least. Any other events on the way out that we're talking about?
So we started the trip with 45 days of food, and we still had a couple weeks of food left, I think, that we ended up high grading the cashews and the
chocolate bars,
the good stuff out of it. And I remember that Steve O'Brien was one of the few people that could handle the sausage at high altitude, and so he was very happy to get, you know, several other shares of summer sausage that the rest of us couldn't hold down. But anyway, we headed on down in record time, and of course, by the time we got down to the Muldrow, almost everything we had was gear. We didn't have enough energy to carry any more food or anything. And I remember the last 24 hours of walking out of there, all I had was yellow lemon hard candies to eat, because I was just didn't have any room to carry anymore.
Yeah, Mike and I, we boogied. He had a job and I had a girlfriend, so we wanted to get out of there quick. The other guys wanted to stick around and mess around for a day or two. It was plenty of food. So I just remembered probably the best shape I was ever in my life. And Mike and I, we just kept going, but we finally got so sleepy we couldn't stay awake. We were literally walking into trees and stuff, so we finally had to stop and camp somewhere shy of Wonder Lake for get some sleep, and of course made it the next day out.
And so the leisurely group, we just stopped and ate dinner every 6 hours or so and kept going mostly. We had developed, while we were on the mountain, a secondary monetary system based on cashews, so we would trade favors or relays or something based on the universal cashew.
So a cryptocurrency, but cashews.
Well, I can add something. I like peanuts better than cashews, and for a while I had them up to, I could trade one cashew for 7 peanuts, and I finally organized and wouldn't go any higher.
Well, you know, on many of these expeditions, food or resources, there's always conflict, but boy, the fact that you guys are sitting here 50-some-odd years later and still our friends are really a testament to your teamwork and the fact that you all get along. And I suspect you had a good reunion with Tom when you got back to town.
So I had one last little anecdote. When Steve and I got out, we got out to park headquarters, and there was a group of Head Start kids there that were just getting on the bus, getting ready to leave, and they had issued them all sack lunches. And they were all throwing their sack lunches into the garbage. They didn't want them. And I was in there in the garbage cans digging out these sack lunches because I had lost 10. I mean, everybody lost weight. I'd lost 10 pounds on the trip over the 30 days. So the sack lunches were a great thing for me anyway.
Well, actually, it was 36 days up and back for the slow party. And so we had 45 days of food, so we only had 9 days that we could have used if we'd been in a storm. Well, actually, we took a few days for rescuing Tom, but that didn't count.
I remember back in those days, we got out finally, right? Eventually make our way to the park headquarters. And in those days, you could rent a shower in one of the rooms in the hotel for an hour. So I bought a six-pack at the store down there and went in the shower for an hour, and I got clean, and I drank it.
That's what.
I just wanted to add one postscript at my end. So I got taken down to Providence Hospital in Anchorage and was checked out for a few days by the pulmonologists and others. So I was down at the hospital with a sleeping bag, my wool pants, no shoes, no jacket, no clue really what was going on. And Peter Brown, who was a college colleague of mine who was a camp follower, he came up with Ed's fiance and was going to celebrate the group afterwards. He took the train down to Anchorage and somehow found me some sneakers, some clothes, put me on a plane, flew me from Anchorage back to the park so that I could go to the park headquarters and obviously thank the Park Service for all they did to haul me off the mountain. So Peter, who climbed Russell with us 2 years later, bailed me out big time out of Anchorage to sort of get me back into the group. And
you flew back. I thought you took the train.
No, you put me on a plane, which was its own little epic adventure. But anyway, thanks to Peter for sort of closing the loop.
We just have a minute or two left here. Any other final thoughts or reflections on trip or mountaineering in general? Sounds like a couple of you continued on and didn't rustle. How did it change some of your directions in your lives?
I'll mention something very small, which was that when we got down and I saw my first mosquito, I was almost in tears to see another living thing on the mountain. An hour later, I had no time for mosquitoes at all. But it was a very strange reaction. It was a very strong one.
Yeah. I had a similar reaction, but I also remember we've been up there for a very long time, and we hadn't exactly taken showers. So we got out with no bathing for over a month, and we couldn't smell each other. We couldn't smell ourselves.
Uh-huh.
We get out to the park road, and jeepers, suddenly we could smell ourselves. It was awful.
And therefore, the shower and the six-pack. Any other closing thoughts from anybody? It's been a great story. Again, this is Outdoor Exploring Alaska Public Media. Oh, we got one more. I think Dan might have closing comments here.
Well, for many years, I used to give slideshows of the climb of McKinley for various people, the Alpine Club and Fairbanks and whatnot. And universally, someone would always ask me at the end of the slideshow, well, does Tom have any serious long-term repercussions? And I said, yes, it's really sad. He went to MIT and got a PhD in toxicology, and he's never been the same.
That's great. Well, thank you, gentlemen, for everything. Appreciate your time, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thanks to my guests, Mike Salee, Tom Kensler, Steve O'Brien, Ed Minot, Dick Jablonowski, and Dan Osborne. Also thanks to Susan Rogers for organizing the interview, and a special thanks to our producer, Eric Bork. This is your host, Paul Tordock, and from all the hosts at Outdoor Explore, thanks for listening, keep climbing, and we'll see you outdoors.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and in your favorite podcast app. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.